Following the dinner party, the dinner encounter that Jesus had with the Pharisees, the scribes, the lawyers, the teachers of the law, they have go by many different names and categories here. Jesus began to instruct his followers at the beginning of Luke chapter 12. During that time, as he taught his the inner core, a group of people started to gather around them. They were listening. And Jesus was teaching his Pharisees on the issue of hypocrisy. He called it the yeast of the Pharisees. Hidden sin that was hidden from the inside by a respectable outside. And because of that, there was amongst these warnings and encouragements, there was quite a bit of resistance building, growing up on the outside. Luke said thousands of people, many thousands gathered here to the point that they were trampling one another. They wanted to get to the front. Have you ever been in a big gathering where there was a lot of people and you're in the back? What did he say? They wanted to move forward. They wanted to hear what the teacher, what the rabbi had to say, maybe see a healing. But certainly, the Pharisees and the lawyers were standing back, frustrated that so many of the people that they had tried to teach and coach to go a different direction were attracted to Jesus. The hostility was growing off to the side. They had been called out, and they didn't like it. Because a true response is humility, not pride, not backlash, not revenge. They were hiding that in their souls, a desire for murder. Our target passage today is a familiar passage. It's the first reaction that we get from this crowd. It's a passage that I preached several years ago, probably I'm figuring back about 14, 15 years ago. During pulpit supply. And you thought, oh, you had an easy week. You just dug out your notes and you got your PowerPoint. No, I couldn't do that. Not at all. Because pulpit supply is not the same as having my own flock. You are my sheep. You are his sheep, but you're also mine. I am a co-shepherd here. And because of that, I started right from the beginning. Because I wanted this to be as real and impactful as it possibly could be. So if you would turn in your Bibles, please, to Luke chapter 12. We're going to continue on verses 13 through 21. Like I said, it's a familiar passage, but it's powerful. Starting Luke 12, verses 13 and 14. It says, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. They acknowledged that Jesus was a teacher, a rabbi, familiar with the Torah, with the Old Testament, the law. And they were often called into arbitration when there was a dispute over the law, an interpretation of it. But this whole issue of family inheritance was laid out pretty clearly in the Old Testament, both in Numbers and then repeated in Deuteronomy. And the gist of it was that the oldest son received a double portion. That's the way it was. That's the way God commanded. In my family, I am the youngest of five, but I'm the only son, so I should have gotten a double portion. Quite honestly, I was fortunate to get anything at all. But we won't go there. But this whole issue of inheritance is pretty dicey, if you've ever been through it. Sometimes the family members got along with each other. They left the estate intact. So they had an entire holding, whatever that was, and they co-managed it together. That would be ideally the way it was. But it wasn't always the case. In a few chapters in Luke chapter 15, we're going to get to another familiar parable, which is the prodigal son. And just to give you just a quick overview of that, just to remind you, there were three players in that. There was a father who was a wealthy man. He had an older son and a younger son. And based on the Old Testament, the older son would get 2/3. And the younger son would get 1/3. And the younger son was a wild guy. And he said, I want my inheritance now. He's the kind of guy who looks and sees a 60-year-old guy pull up at a stoplight in a Corvette and says, what a waste. You know, you're not impressing anybody with your wrinkles and your gray hair. You know, you got to be a kid. You got to enjoy the sports car. You got to be able to do burnouts. And that's what he lived like. And the father indulged him. He gave him the inheritance, and he went out and he squandered it in wild living. Well, think about that. If you had 2/3 of your estate solid and 1/3 was suddenly taken away, that could destabilize everything. But the father did it. It's no wonder that the older brother was the angry one. And we'll get to that in a little while and tear that one apart, tease it apart. But that kind of gives you an idea here of inheritance and the tension that could bring about. In this situation right here, we do not know anything about the man other than he called out. The rest of the details are unknown. But one thing is sure. He was not asking Jesus for help. Go back and take a look at that. He says, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. He knew in his own personal economy what the outcome should be, and he was scripting Jesus to say, this is what you should tell him. You should be on my side. You know, when emotions get in the way of logic, we have a way of getting there and saying, there's only one way to see it, and that's through my eyes. Ever been there? Yeah. Everybody, if you're not nodding, you're not telling the truth. Because we've all kind of lost objectivity in the process. Tell my brother. My brother's the jerk here. We don't know. So Jesus replied, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Letting that sink in just a little bit. This is the second time that Jesus has shrugged off getting in the middle of family drama. The first one was a pair of sisters, Mary and Martha. And it was somewhat the same attitude. Martha got her dander up. She was in working. Mary was sitting at Jesus' feet. She finally stomped in and she goes, what is wrong with you? Can't you see I'm doing all the work? Tell her to get in here. Tell. You know, it's like Jesus' dad. I'm going to tell on you, and dad is going to make you do what I want. And Jesus says, that's not how it's going to be. I'm not getting in the middle of this, because what the fact of the matter is, you do not know the situation. Solomon says in Proverbs that every person seems right if they are the first person to tell their side. Until the other person comes in. You can see that on Judge Judy and all those TV jury shows. And someone comes in and makes this case and sounds the other person sound awful. And then they tell their side of the story and you go, huh. Well, isn't that interesting? Because there are two sides here. But we see a combative attitude. This man is upset. But what it does is it reveals where his heart is right now. So the story goes on, and Jesus, of course, looks up the brother and tells him, you give this guy his inheritance, right? No, that's not it. That's not it at all. Because it says in verse 15, then he said to them, still teaching his disciples, but the crowd is listening, watch out, with an exclamation mark. Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Because the fact of the matter is that both sides could be suffering from the same issue. Jesus identifies it as greed. This is what teachers would call a teachable moment. Maybe parents, you've been in the same situation where you've got kids squabbling and all of a sudden you go, this is a good place to teach a really powerful lesson. And Jesus does it by identifying first the issue. With Martha, he says, Martha, you are troubled about many things. You had things that have been building up in the background. This is the last straw. Jesus says the problem here is greed. Greed is a violation of the 10th commandment. Thou shalt not covet. What does covet mean? Covet means to have an unhealthy desire or a compulsion for wealth and gain. An unhealthy. Does it mean that you can't have things? No. What it means is that you need to keep these things in balance. That's why Jesus says, be on your guard, because this is easy. This creeps in. He goes on, he says, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Boy, is this a sermon for America today, especially with Amazon. Sunday nights, we meet up with our son Pete and Kat and our grandkids over on Alpine, over at Culver's to see the kids. It's kind of a common spot, and we go by where the Amazon hub is. And we pass, even on a Sunday, because people are buying and delivered right to your door. And boy, you know, have you seen the commercial where the guy says, oh, I looked at my credit card bill and I'm not going to be able to order from you? And he's sad because he's developed a relationship with his Amazon or UPS driver. This is kind of what we're talking about here. Jesus doesn't clarify the sides. He says the issue is greed between the whole situation and this inheritance. Likely each side is struggling with the same issue, the same sinful attitudes. Because the fact of the matter is, everything we have is a blessing from the Lord. Everything. Everything. In one of his letters, one of his epistles, Paul goes through his pedigree. And he says, I am a Jew among Jews. He said, I am born in the tribe of Benjamin, and I was raised as a Pharisee, and I have all this training. He says, as far as the law, I was righteous. And that would be like laying out here and saying, you know, I have these degrees, and I have this, and I have a seminary, and I have a ordination certificate on my wall. And you go, if it doesn't change who you are, big deal. Big deal. Because everything that I have, everything you have, was given to you. Your intelligence, your drive. It isn't, I earned this. You know, I've run across people saying, I earned this. I worked hard. I deserve this. You have to make sure that your attitude is right. Because the major commentary that I read went right where I went in my own thinking. Because you go from greed to covetousness to idolatry. Idolatry means that you love the gift more than the giver. Because you take what God gave you and you love it so much you forget God. And that's going to be the gist of this going on in verses 16 and 17. Jesus didn't leave it there. He says, I've identified the problem as greed. He says, now I'm going to give you a word picture. He says, he told them a parable. A parable. Four times in Luke, there are parables given from a negative point of view about possessions. Luke is a physician. He has a patron. He had someone, he's in a pretty stable position. But four times he talks about this, these word pictures. He says, the ground of a certain man yielded an abundant harvest. The days of having a mule in one of those plows like this are long gone. This is how they harvest corn today. They have a big, huge harvester that has the spout, and they run a semi-truck with an open top right alongside of it, and it's filling that up with that grain so hardly anything hits the ground. They get a complete yield. And if you live out here, you're very familiar with the odor of cow manure because they're enriching that soil and they're getting every drop out of it. An abundant harvest. You might think, well, what's wrong with that? You work hard, you get a yield for your effort. But this apparent blessing was also a test. Sometimes the biggest tests don't come out of lack. It comes out of excess. It comes out of abundance. A test from the Lord to check your heart condition. So Jesus goes inside the man's mind, this rich man, this wealthy man. And he says he thought to himself, what should I do? I have no place to store my crops. What a bad situation to be in. The crop is so abundant, he doesn't have enough room to store it. Jesus has proven a number of times that he is the reader of thoughts. So we get the inner mindset and process thinking of this man. We get an inner dialogue of the wealthy. And I want you to note in the next couple verses, the pronouns. There are personal pronouns. I, me, mine, myself. All aimed at his own needs. Looking inward, not outward. Not at the needs of others. There's a dilemma growing here because the man only sees what's in the mirror. What should I do? In verses 18 and 19. Then he said, he's still thinking to himself. Jesus is reading his mind. This is what I'll do. He comes to a solution. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. You know, on a pragmatic level, on a surface level, this sounds like a fairly decent solution. You have a really big harvest. What are you going to do with it? Well, I'm going to find a place to store it so that I have a steady source of income. He's going to save this abundance for the future. Now you think about it and you go, well, there's a biblical principle about this. Joseph, the son of Jacob Esau, he is sold to slavers and he goes to Egypt. And when he gets out of the dungeon from the ability to read dreams given by God, he's made the viceroy of Egypt and he has a dream about a famine. And he starts stockpiling grain there for the nation and for the region because this famine is coming. Now, here's something interesting about this, and this is a side note. They've never really figured out what the pyramids were for. We were taught in school they were for burial, but they don't find burial, the remains of people there. Those are in the Valley of the Kings. And some have said maybe that's where the grain was stored during those famines, that they would fill up those pyramids and they would be sealed, and then the grain was brought out as they needed it. I thought, well, that was interesting. I don't know that that's a fact. Maybe we'll find that out in heaven. But the fact of the matter was when Joseph did that, he was under the direction of the Lord to save people, including his family in Canaan. That's not the case here. This might be provocative. This might step on toes. I'm going to say it anyway. We have in this area some really, really productive dairy farms. There are some massive barns. There are countless cows. When you go by some of them, you go, how do you keep track of that many cows? And I said to Joni recently, before this message, there is a structure that I have never seen a cow in. I have never seen a farm implement in. This structure just sits there empty because whoever built it, for whatever reason, they built a bigger barn behind it to put other cows in. And I thought, how different are we? How different is our society? This is not about first century. This is all about every generation. He says, I'll just build bigger barns. I'll tear the old ones down. Now it's going to get worse. He says, and then I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take it easy. Take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. And this is where the problem lies of all the me, mine, his, him. Is a man expresses the inside of his heart is twisted. It's twisted with greed. The blessings that he had been given as a test was going to be used for nothing more than to bring ease to himself, to make it easier for himself. He says, I don't have to work anymore. I've got such a turnout. And now all of a sudden, this doesn't have to be about farming. This could be about, I made an investment, and all of a sudden, I've got this really big yield. Now I can just take it easy. Eat, drink, be merry. Life is nothing but a party. Yay. What could be wrong with that? In that day and age, there was a group of Greek people who lived that way. They were called Epicureans. And the Epicureans were people who were all about sensual pleasure. It was all about taking care of themselves and having the richest food and the richest whatever. This man was falling into that trap. Let's eat, drink, and be merry. Is there a problem with enjoying what God has blessed you with? No. But there is a line. And Jesus is laying that line out. Because when it turns to self-serving, there's no care for the need of others. Because this is an opportunity to use the abundance for others. And I'm going to be really boldly honest on the other side. If this man had sold everything that he had, all the barns, all the grain, everything that he owned, and gave it to the poor, there would still be poor. Jesus said that you'll always have poor. Our own government welfare system has proven that handing money to people does not solve poverty. Why is it? Because then they sit back and say, I have a life of ease, eat, drink, and be merry because I don't have to work. It's the same exact problem on either side. When Jesus was anointed with that expensive perfume, and Judas goes, that could have been sold and given to the poor. He was greedy. Do you see what's going on here? It's the same type of mentality. It's all there right in the background. Instead of seeing the people around him as image bearers of God and saying, how can I bless others because God has blessed me? He chooses to do nothing but serve himself. This is where the problem is. The problem isn't the blessing. The problem isn't even the barns. Because if he had been out in helping other people with the surplus. But the problem is it was all about him. That was it. Plain and simple. In verse 20, the whole thing is going to come to a screeching halt. Because the Father, Jesus is telling this. He is the God-man, and he says, but God said to him, you fool. You fool. And you go, wait a minute. And Jesus, in Matthew chapter 5, warned not to call people a fool. And the word there, the Greek word is raka, which means empty head. Calling somebody brain dead, somebody stupid. Nowadays in social media, they have taken the R word, retard, out of it, so you can't even say that. But those are hurtful words. Those are terrible things to call people. And Jesus warns, and he says, you are in danger of hellfire and judgment if that's the way you treat people, calling them that. Raka, brain dead, empty head. That is not what God is saying here. There's another Greek word. It's ephron. It means moral and spiritual deficiency. It means a person who does not take God into consideration. He does not take other people into consideration. It's only through their own tiny little lens of looking at what their own money can do for them personally. Lacking godly wisdom. This is a strong rebuke. God says, you fool. You have been blessed and you are an abject failure with the abundance. God says another thing. He says, this very night, your life will be demanded from you. This man envisioned that this crop, these barns were going to give him years of ease. He was going to be able to live it up indefinitely. And the fact of the matter was, he was not even going to make it through the night. You know what this reminds me of is the book of Daniel. When the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, he's holding a booze party in the capital of Babylon, and he calls for the cups and the goblets from the temple of God in Israel that they had raided to be used as a booze party. And suddenly a hand appears on the wall, and it writes, many, many, tekel parson, which means you've been weighed, you've been measured, and you've been found wanting. This is exactly it. And God says, because of this, because of your attitudes, tonight your life will be demanded of you. I'm sorry if that's a shocking picture, but that's exactly what it is. He says, you're going to be a toe tag. You're not even going to be able to enjoy one night of this. Your life will be demanded of you. Your very being, your soul will be demanded of you. That twisted inside of his. He had squandered the opportunity to help others. His life had turned into a total disaster. God says, you fool. Tonight your life is going to be demanded of you. And then God asks a question, a rhetorical question. He says, then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? Who's going to get it? You know, young people are concerned about acquiring, maybe reaching the status of their parents or exceeding that, about doing well, of having a nest egg to live through the rest of their life. That's a question that goes through your mind as you gain some years. What's going to happen to my stuff? When my mom passed away almost 25 years ago, my sisters organized a yard sale. And like a bunch of vultures, people were coming in and stuff was dirt cheap. And, you know, and one guy came in, he goes, I'll give you $5 for this entire table. I said, you need to leave. I was not very pastoral at that point in time. He goes, what do you mean? I said, this is my mom's stuff. And I said, you are being disrespectful. I said, get in your car and go. Why? I said, no. I said, you don't own this property. You don't understand. You go. Because your possessions are laying on a table and people are fighting over them like a flea market. You go, wow, that's sobering, isn't it? But that's not a new thought. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, Koheleth, that's the Hebrew name for a teacher, often attributed to Solomon. Solomon, all of the great things that he had done when he was a young man and took over for his father David as the king of Israel, had prayed for wisdom, and he was given all of these things. He is given wisdom and honor and knowledge and wealth. And he built the temple and he built his own palace and he did all of these things so that people from all over the world came to see Solomon. These are the words of Solomon. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and my skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all of my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all that they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do you think of that? That's biblical. That's right there. That's a man saying, you know what? I have acquired, I've worked, and I've got blessings right here, and I have to leave it to somebody who I don't know what they're going to do with it. I hope they're like the older son in the prodigal son than the younger son who goes out and blows it and squanders it. But you don't know. That's why sometimes very wealthy people get involved in donorship and trust and foundations. That's why when you go to Grand Rapids, you see certain names on hospitals and sports arenas and the museums and things like that, because they left a legacy that is going to last longer than their children can spend the money. That's a question God asks him. What do you think is going to happen to everything you have? Your holdings, your big barns, your surplus. That's not the end of it. Verse 21. Jesus concludes. He says, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves and is not rich towards God. That is the moral of the story. This is a cautionary parable. A test from the Lord. A challenge to you, what do you do when things go well? How a person handles blessings and prosperity. Do you keep it for yourself? Because that's where you end up. That's where we all do. Solomon did. Solomon's son did. Jeroboam, he was a mess. He lost the kingdom in just a couple years. The whole thing was, that's when the divided kingdom came about. And you know what this reminds me of? Scrooge from Christmas Carol. I've talked about this quite a bit already this spring because I watched three different versions of A Christmas Carol over Christmas this year. And it really stuck with me that Charles Dickens knew what he was talking about because the story of Scrooge is really the parable of the rich fool without this conclusion right here. Scrooge sees the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future, and he wakes up and he goes, am I alive? And he gets a second chance. The rich fool does not. God says, tonight your spirit, your soul, your life, everything you have is demanded of you. There's no second chance. And the moral of the story, Whoever stores up things for them, themselves, but is not rich towards God. You have to remember the giver. That's why in the Old Testament, when it talks about offerings, it talks about giving, it talks about first fruits. It means that instead of laying out your budget and laying out your income and saying, all these come here, yeah, and there's $4 left for God to put into the offering plate. No, you take it off the top and the rest falls into place. That's what first fruits are. You take it off the top and God knows the difference. Well, I put some in. Are you being rich towards God? You know, if you've been to a quarterly meeting here, you know where we put it. We take care of this building. Our parking lot needs some work. We could use a new sign. You hear the missions committee. Tara, tell us how many missionaries that you guys have looked at. And you have to narrow it down to one because we just don't have the finances, right? We would love, what if we had 10 times the income and we could get 10 new missionaries to spread the gospel? Does that excite you just a little bit? How does that happen? Being rich towards God. Two men in the Bible at the very beginning describe what this was all about. One's name was Abel and one's name was Cain. Abel came to the Lord with an open hand and he gave God willingly. He was blessed for it. He was a welcome son. Cain was not. Cain had a different kind of heart. He had a jealous heart, a stingy heart, a murderous heart. And you know where they ended up. Abel ended up in the ground, and Cain ended up a fugitive. Who was rich towards God? I know. This is powerful stuff. As we close this morning, as we reflect, how many of you have heard the name Corrie Ten Boom? Anybody here, Corrie Ten Boom? A few of you have. Corrie Ten Boom was a lady. She was a young lady. She was Dutch, born in the Netherlands during World War II. Her father was a watchmaker. They were simple folks. And during World War II, they snuck Jewish refugees into their house to spare them from the Nazis, and they were found out. And Corrie Ten Boom, as a teenager, late teen, early 20s lady, was sent to a concentration camp. She lost everything. This is what she said. You may never know that Jesus is all you need until Jesus is all you have. She had nothing. You know, this has really challenged me this week, and I hope it does you too. Because you might get to a certain point where Jesus is all you have. And I sure hope it's enough. Because if you're a believer and you stand before Jesus at the judgment seat of Christ and he says, what did you do with your time and your blessings, your talents? What did you do with them? Well, I had a really nice boat. Enough said. Think on these things. Let's close in prayer. Lord, this is so profound, so deep. It cuts to my heart, and I hope it does to these folks and to whoever hears. These are your words. Lord, teach us what it means to be rich towards you. Teach us to be givers and not just receivers. Not to think that our efforts are what yield us what you bless us with. Because it's so easy. I have known people who have experienced house fires and they have lost everything, Lord, and I've thought about that. What if you were at ground zero and literally with no place to go and everything that you valued was gone? every possession, every picture, every stash of money, and it can happen. And it happens with sickness. People on their deathbed aren't thinking about what they're leaving behind. Lord, help us to be the kind of servants, the kind of stewards that you have for us to be. Teach us, Lord. Make us grateful people. In your name we pray. Amen.